You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, this week's warm spell melted a lot of snow and has caused flooding in various parts of the state. We'll talk about the floods and how you can stay safe when you're in your community. First, it's time for a look at some of the week's news in state politics. Republican lawmakers are planning to hire private attorneys to defend the state in a lawsuit involving Planned Parenthood. The GOP-controlled legislature continues to criticize Governor Evers' budget proposal, and a Wisconsin congressional representative is accusing a U.S. immigration agency of being dishonest about arrests made last year in the Madison area. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob.
We're in our different studio now. People may not know this. We haven't talked about this big construction work going on. We're in a temporary studio right now.
You can't hear it, but for us, it's a big deal.
It's pretty weird and different. All right. Now back to the news around the state. We've got these private lawyers now. Republican lawmakers are looking to hire some for this lawsuit from Planned Parenthood. Instead of counting on Attorney General Josh Call, give us some background here.
Yeah, this is kind of an offshoot of the new dynamic in state government, where you have Democrats holding the statewide offices, specifically governor and attorney general, and Republicans running the legislature. This comes from a lawsuit that Planned Parenthood filed in January that seeks to repeal state laws that make it more difficult for women, particularly those in rural areas, to receive abortions. Those restrictions include a law requiring that only doctors perform abortions, a law requiring women seeking medicine that causes abortions see the same doctor on two separate visits, and a law that requires doctors to be physically present when dispensing abortion-causing drugs. So they argue that those requirements are unconstitutional, that they don't enhance the health and safety of patients, but rather unconstitutionally limit access to abortions in Wisconsin.
Now, usually, apart from the merits of the case one way or the other, usually you sue the state of Wisconsin. The defense is provided by the state's attorney general in his office, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, that is he is the state's lawyer. So the attorney general is elected to defend the state in most cases. He doesn't have to do that, though. And we have had instances this year where Attorney General Call has not done it.
Mm-hmm. And so has he said one way or the other whether he's going to defend the state in this instance?
So in this instance, he is defending the state, but he hasn't come out and said what his position is going to be. Mm-hmm. And so Republican lawmakers are not going to wait to find out. What they did this week is they circulated a ballot that would let them hire private attorneys to try to intervene in the case. They'd need the judge, the federal judge overseeing this case, to let them do that. But they want to go out and hire their own lawyer because they don't trust Call, essentially.
Is this something we see in Wisconsin history, the legislature trying to pursue its own legal angle?
I mean, it's something we're seeing a lot more now than in recent memory, for sure. I mean, it could be that we had this, decades ago, potentially. I don't know. But right now, it's very prominent. It keeps coming up in cases where the state is being sued, the governor is being sued in his official capacity. We have some really complicated webs where the state is either a defendant or the governor is a defendant, and Republicans have reached out and hired their own attorneys, and Governor Evers has hired his own attorneys, too.
And as you say, even if they hire attorneys, it's not a done deal. The federal court has to recognize the existence of those attorneys and their right to argue the case alongside, I guess, the attorney general.
Yes, it's up to U.S. Judge, District Judge William Conley to approve them intervening. And I don't know what kind of precedent there would be for that in federal court, if that's just kind of a given that the answer will be yes or no. In state court so far, Republican lawmakers have had some success in hiring their own attorney to get involved in some of these other lawsuits involving the extraordinary session, the lame duck session we had in December. This one's in federal court, though.
Let's move on. We'll keep watching that story. We are in a budget year, which makes the budget process the big story in Wisconsin politics. Governor Evers released his own proposals. What are Republicans in the legislature saying they're going to do now?
The night that he released his budget, they were saying, we're going to do our own thing. I mean, it was Senator Fitzgerald who was most adamant that the governor pretty much had left them no choice. He was talking about people in his caucus, the Senate Republican caucus, who were going to look at the governor's budget and say, we can't do this. And so we're going to build our own budget. What that means in practice, I think we're going to still have to find out because, I don't know that they're going to toss the whole thing out and say, let's go write our own budget, or if it's a case where they take the budget vote by vote and have the governor's choice as an option and then their own choice, which is much less money probably in a lot of these cases as an option. They can also, with a lot of these policy items that the governor has put in there, automatic voter registration, for example, a repeal of right to work, they can just put those on a list and say, hey, these are all policy. They don't have to do with the budget. Let's take them all out of there right now. That's pretty common when you have a split government, a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature.
What are some of the things in the budget, apart from those policy items you just mentioned, that Republicans say are such deal breakers that this isn't even a valid starting point?
One thing that seems to be coming back quite a bit is the governor's proposal to expand Medicaid in Wisconsin from people who earn up to 100% of the federal poverty level to people who earn up to 138% of the federal poverty level. It's a big deal because that is a piece of the budget that the governor has said is crucial. You know, his budget is kind of built around this expansion of Medicaid. He feels like it's embraced by the public, so he's out there talking about it regularly, and his cabinet secretaries are out there talking about it regularly. They want to talk about this. And every time they do, it seems like it provokes a stronger response from Republicans. I'm thinking about Speaker Voss in this case, who say, no, no way, it's not going to happen. Speaker Voss called it welfare this week. We're not going to expand welfare, talking about the expansion of Medicaid. If they don't do that, if Republicans are adamant that you can't expand Medicaid, that is a lot of money that is not freed up in the budget, and a lot of what the governor wants to do can't get done.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, about some of the big news in state politics this week. Something else that the legislature has to do is approve some of Governor Evers' appointees, cabinet appointees. The governor's nominee to be State Secretary of Safety and Professional Services, Dawn Krim, is facing some resistance in her confirmation process. What's going on?
This goes back to an incident in 2005 when Krim admitted to poking her then 5-year-old son's hand with a pen until it bled. The incident occurred after Krim read a letter from her son's school saying he'd poked another student with a pencil. The case was dismissed and no trial was held. Krim agreed to fulfill the requirements of a deferred prosecution agreement. She told lawmakers this week that that agreement required her to not have any brushes with the law for 6 months and to enroll in parenting classes. And according to documents released by the Evers administration, Krim later appealed the charges to the Dane County Department of Human Services, and they were dropped. But, I mean, I guess that coming out just recently is what Republican lawmakers, Republican senators specifically, are looking into. They asked her about it at a confirmation hearing this week. They have to give her a—I mean, they have the ability to reject her confirmation if they want to. They haven't said they're going to do that. They've just said that they're scrutinizing her record at this point.
So they haven't given a signal one way or the other whether they would confirm her based on this information that's out there.
They haven't said firmly that this is going to cause us to vote no. Mm-hmm. In fact, what they seem to be focusing on is not what happened in 2005 or how that was resolved. They seem to be focusing on the fact that Governor Evers didn't tell them about this stuff and that it was reported in the press a couple weeks ago for the first time. That's how they found out about it. They're more focused on sort of the process of how they learned about it and Evers' decision to nominate her rather than what Krim has said and done.
And just process-wise, more broadly, Sean, the governor appoints cabinet secretaries and just the state Senate then weighs in on those?
That's right. And it's not like a federal judgeship or something where a president nominates somebody and they don't get to start serving unless the Senate confirms. Mm-hmm. When it's a cabinet secretary, a governor appoints them. They're running the agency one way or another until they get whether or not they get Senate confirmation. Excuse me. So Dawn Krim is the secretary of the Department of Safety and Professional Services. For all intents and purposes, she doesn't have Senate confirmation right now, but she can do her job, as can the other cabinet secretaries, without that Senate confirmation.
And then Congressman Mark Pocan had filed a Freedom of Information Act for ICE, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. This is going back to some raids in Wisconsin, including the Madison area, part of his district. What is happening there? What's going on?
He's saying that the federal government overstated the number of people with criminal histories who were arrested in a raid from last year. So shortly after this raid, ICE released a statement saying that more than half of the 83 individuals that they had arrested had prior criminal histories. In October, Pocan said that he asked the federal government to share information about the criminal histories of those apprehended. He received that information last month. He said that his office was only able to confirm criminal records for 23 people. Reporters, WPR included, reached out to ICE for comment. They did not respond to the congressman's press conference where he talked about this.
And what's he looking at now as a next step? He's saying he's not getting all the information he wants from ICE, apparently.
Big picture, he's saying that this is an agency that's running rogue under the president, that the president's using it as a, quote, police force, his personal police force, in order to justify his wall. And so Pocan, who represents a very liberal district in Wisconsin, is putting a lot of pressure on this and saying ICE needs to back off.
And then finally, Sean, a lot of buzz about this announcement this week from the Democratic National Committee saying they're going to hold their convention in Milwaukee in 2020. That's a big deal. Presidential convention. What are you seeing? What are you hearing from people in the state capitol about this?
I mean, Democrats are pretty excited, obviously. This is a huge deal for them. This is where the entire national party apparatus is going to come together, nominate a candidate for president, talk about the direction of their party. And their picking of Wisconsin is saying, hey, you, Wisconsin, are extremely important to us. You're a small state in terms of electoral votes. Milwaukee is not a huge city among those that were in the running for this convention, but it got picked because of Wisconsin's importance in this. And so it gives Wisconsin Democrats kind of a chance to shine in a national stage with this convention.
And Republicans have been responding. They're concerned. They're interested in Milwaukee's socialist past, reaching back a half century or so.
Yeah, kind of some backhanded compliments from Republicans. The state Republican Party saying it's a perfect location for Democrats because, I mean, when you think about this in the context of the national debate now, what are Republicans saying about Democrats? They're saying they're lurching to the left, that they're becoming a socialist party. And hey, look, it's just perfect that they're gathering in Milwaukee, which has had socialist mayors in its past. It's worth noting that Milwaukee has also been the home to many a state Republican convention there. So it's not like they're averse to gathering there themselves.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR Capital Bureau Chief, here to catch us up on the week's news in state politics. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court isn't the only game in town. We'll check out the large number of judges appointed to lower courts and the impact they can have on American law and politics. First, every year, millions of people 65 and older fall. And while most falls do not cause injuries, one out of five does lead to serious complications. Meanwhile, Wisconsin has one of the highest rates of death from unintentional falls in the nation, twice the national average. As you think about what you or your loved ones can do to prevent these kind of dangerous falls, you might want to think about turning to the yoga mat. Dr. Irene Hamrick is a professor of family medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison who studied how yoga practice can improve balance and reduce falls for seniors. Dr. Hamrick, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into this research on yoga and falls, can you talk about the importance of dealing with this issue of falls itself? Why is this so important?
Yeah, one-third of older adults over 65 fall each year, and that number increases to 50% at age 80 and older. So it's very, very common. But patients who sustain a hip fracture from a fall have a 50% chance of dying the following year because it's just so devastating, and a large number of them will not recover enough to live independently by themselves.
And why did you decide to research yoga in particular, and a particular kind of yoga, hatha or hatha yoga?
Yeah, so the yoga we chose is also called chair yoga. So it does not require the participant to get onto the floor. And the poses all can be done in a standing position while holding on to a chair or another surface like the wall. So it was much more acceptable. However, in future studies, we might want to include the floor because one of the reviewers, when we submitted it for publication, stated that as patients fall, they really need to learn how to get up from the floor. So having floor yoga included might also give them the tools to get up from a fall, should that happen.
And how much of this yoga did study participants do?
They participated in the class twice a week for 8 weeks, and it was an hour-long class. And then we split the group. There were 38 participants, and we split half of them to do home exercises of yoga and the other one, including meditation and breathing exercises, and the other half did only the meditation and breathing exercises, not the yoga poses at home, because we wanted to see if there was a difference between before and after, but also between the groups to see if those who practiced at home would have better outcomes.
We're talking to Dr. Irene Hamrick from UW-Madison, looking at the idea of using yoga to help prevent falls among people 65 and older. So, Dr. Hamrick, they did these yoga poses. They had a little bit of variation in what they did. What did you find? What were the results in terms of balance and fall prevention?
So we showed improvement in all balance and strength parameters that we measured, such as the Berg balance test and a number of other measures. But in addition to these intermediary measures, we also found falls reduction.
How much? How much of a difference did this seem to make?
So we had initially, we asked patients how much they had fallen before the study started. So in the 6 months before the study, 15 participants reported 27 falls. After the intervention, and we started counting and at the onset of the classes because our study was rather short in funding. So we started when classes started and then counted 6 months, and 13 participants had 14 falls over those 6 months, so an almost 50% reduction.
So what is it about yoga that that would be helping people have better balance and avoid falls? Is it the physical activity? Is it being more conscious of what you're doing? Do we know why this would work?
That's an excellent question, and we don't really know. It was particularly interesting that the home exercise group did not improve any more than the group that did not practice at home. So just showing up for the class might be enough to stimulate the brain-muscle connection to improve balance and reduce falls. But we had a small study, so this really needs to be replicated in a larger study. But when we asked participants what they thought made the difference, they said, I'm much more aware of the 4 points of my foot on the floor. So it might have also been more the awareness, but we also don't know how much meditation or breathing exercises might have contributed to the improvement in falls. That is all something that needs to be studied further.
This study involved yoga and balance and falls prevention. You've looked at other interventions, too. What kind of things have you studied?
I have, with Dr. Jane Mahoney from the University of Wisconsin, rolled out the program of lifestyle intervention for functional exercise. This was a study done by Dr. Clemson out of Australia that integrated exercises into daily activities. Most of us who participate in classes for falls reduction, we'll oftentimes do the exercises while we're doing the class, but after the class stops, we tend to not continue the exercises at home, and then the effect wanes over time. So Dr. Clemson's premise was, if we integrate exercise into daily activities, we're more likely to continue them afterwards. Plus, people are more likely to do them if it doesn't take any extra additional time. So, for example, while brushing our teeth, we balance on one leg, or while we're wiping the table, we partially squat to build our quadricep muscles for balance. And, for example, while I do emails, I spend a lot of time in front of the computer, I partially squat and lean to all four directions to reach the limit of my sway to increase my balance muscles.
That's fascinating, because I think a lot of people, I'll include myself here, we think if I'm going to do some form of exercise, it means I have to set aside time for it. There might be equipment. I might have to go to a gym. And that means in many cases, I just don't do it. So it sounds like this plan would help people integrate it into their daily lives.
Exactly. So we're hoping to increase the repertoire that we can offer to patients if they are at risk of falls to prevent future falls, because some patients might want to do yoga, others might not, and they might need to integrate their exercise into daily activities because they have a very busy schedule.
How much of this is a mindset issue? As I get older, I imagine I'll be less interested in doing physical activity. It might not be on my radar. How important is it just to get people thinking, hey, if I do this physical activity, even at a limited level, it's going to make me safer and healthier?
That is an important piece. We really have to change the mindset of all of us, because more and more data is coming out of the benefits of exercise for everything from cancer to preventing dementia and, of course, falls.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Hamrick, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Dr. Irene Hamrick is a professor of family medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She shared how practicing yoga can help prevent dangerous falls among seniors. Coming up, we'll talk about Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's efforts to reshape the federal judiciary and what that means for the American legal system. The U.S. Supreme Court gets a lot of the attention, but there's a lot going on at the lower court levels as well. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7 on The Morning Show, state lawmakers are forming a paper caucus to advocate for the role of the paper industry in the state's economy. Join Kate Archer-Kent and her guests for a look at the issues they're hoping to raise. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, despite some controversy, President Trump's pick to replace now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed by the Senate this week. Judge Naomi Rao became the 36th judge Trump has appointed to the federal courts of appeals, which, according to the Washington Post, means that he's now appointed one out of every five circuit court judges. The appointments are part of a broader effort to change the ideological makeup of the federal court system, a priority for both the president and for Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Kimmy King is a professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back.
Let's start with this latest bit of news, Kimmy. Naomi Rao, the president's pick to replace Brett Kavanaugh since he moved up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Why was her confirmation controversial?
It was controversial because of some things that she had said in her earlier days, also in part because of her judicial background. She doesn't have the typical kind of judicial record that we look for in someone going on to one of the courts of appeals. And it's also because this is because it's a very tense time in terms of the Senate judicial nominees, and it comes on the heels of Brett Kavanaugh's appointment to the Supreme Court and a record number of appeals judges being appointed by President Trump.
We pay a lot of attention to the Supreme Court, Kimmy, us in the media, I think the public and voters. Can you talk about the importance of these appeals courts?
So the fact of the matter is that where the real action happens in the federal court system is in the federal district courts, and then it's in the federal courts of appeal. And quite frequently, we do not pay nearly enough attention to those courts because they decide the vast majority of cases. Last year, we saw, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court decide only 69 cases, but you will see thousands of cases decided in the courts of appeals and over hundreds of thousands of cases decided in the district courts. And so if you want to systematically change what kinds of cases land in front of the Supreme Court, the action is in the lower federal courts. And President Trump has appointed a record number of judges in those lower courts, given the limited term that he's had in office.
Why has he been able to appoint a record number?
It's because, in large part, knowing that they were coming into a 2016 potentially successful presidential candidate and then holding the Oval Office, the Republicans began to strategically block President Obama's lower court appointments and then additionally Supreme Court appointments in the last 2 years of President Obama's presidency. And so they are kind of reaping the benefits of being able to fill all of these vacancies. In fact, after this last set of appointments to the judicial, to the federal courts of appeals, President Trump will have now appointed 1 in 5 federal appellate judges on the bench, and that's fairly substantial when you look at the numbers.
Are these lifetime appointments, these appeals court judgeships, as are Supreme Court appointments?
Yes, they are, and it's very difficult to remove them. The fact of the matter is that we have about 179 authorized courts of appeal judges and 673 authorized federal district court judges. And so these judges will serve for a lifetime tenure. And so keep in mind that in the last 2 years, the GOP-led Senate has put on, you know, 2 Supreme Court justices, as many as President Obama was able to put on, 30 circuit court judges, and 53 lower court judges. So President Trump and Senator Mitch McConnell, as well as the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Lindsey Graham, have moved very quickly and very efficiently in making sure that these vacancies that had stood out there for so long under President Obama were quickly filled.
And it sounds like it's becoming harder for the minority party in the Senate to block judicial appointments. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. In fact, one of the things that you saw this last week was that there was a planned conference change in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And what they're going to be doing is they're going to be limiting debate to 2 hours on judicial appointments rather than the customary 30 hours after you get that vote of cloture, which the vote of cloture is just a fancy way to close off debate. So that's one way in which the GOP-led Senate has been able to change the rules. But where you've also seen the Democrats, you know, yelling outrage has been in the change of the blue slip process. And so if you look at Paul Mady, who was just recently confirmed to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals the same week that Rao was confirmed, he was confirmed 54-45, and the 2 home state senators who are Democrats, Robert Menendez and Cory Booker, were opposed to that candidate. Now, in the past, it's been customary that there's this thing called the blue slip. And that's just kind of a customary procedure where you say, hey, this guy is from my home state. We support his nomination to the federal bench because we're the 2 senators from that state. And it's really just a senatorial courtesy. Well, they refused to return the blue slip on Paul Mady. He's an ex-staff member for New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, former Governor Chris Christie. And so they didn't like him, and they didn't want him confirmed, and they refused to return the blue slip. And the Senate said, well, you know, forget you. We don't care. We don't care about the blue slip, and we don't care about the senatorial courtesy that has been traditionally been offered. So things are getting really nasty in the Senate.
Talking to Kimmy King, professor of political science in the University of North Texas, looking at judicial appointments, the stuff not in the limelight, below the U.S. Supreme Court level. Kimmy, let's talk about now the, I guess, kind of judges, the ideological background of judges. A lot of people point toward the role of the Federalist Society in providing lists of recommendations for potential judges at the Supreme Court level. Talk about that group and what influence they might have.
So one of the things that they do that's incredibly important is that in terms of the kinds of cases that are ultimately passed forward and the decisions that they render, they are creating the record that would ultimately be passed on to the Supreme Court. So particularly in instances of things like abortion or sexual assault, for example, has been one of the issues that Rao got into trouble too. One of the reasons that they did not like her appointment was that she had said controversial things about if women were drunk, they needed to take more responsibility if some kind of harm befell them in sexual assault cases. Well, that sparked a great deal of outrage. And so it's this concern that that kind of ideology will be critical in shaping what kinds of cases we get to the high court. And moreover, if a case doesn't get to the Supreme Court, remember, the federal courts of appeal are the last word. It remains the law for that circuit. and those states in that circuit until the Supreme Court finally does decide a case that's similar to it. And so it sets up a record for cases in the future that may have a conservative bent. In terms of the kinds of judges that President Trump has been appointing, yes, he has been following the Federalist Society very closely. They're a very conservative organization that looks at the background and the ideology of judges that are nominated to the courts. But also remember that Kavanaugh didn't come in as high on the Federalist list as some people would have liked. And that was one of the criticisms about him before then all of the scandal broke regarding the alleged, the allegations that had been made by Professor Ford. So in general, you are going to be watching for people following the records of the Trump appointees as compared to, say, President Obama or even President Bush before him, because there's reason to believe that these judges will be much more conservative, be more ideologically driven, and will not necessarily be or come from a typical background that we've seen some judges in the past.
Is there a counterpart to the Federalist Society that Democrats rely on when they're in control of the White House?
So they absolutely look to a number of different organizations. One of the things that Republicans have been very critical of is that Republicans have argued that the American Bar Association, which gives ratings to judges, it has long been a criticism out of conservative senators that the American Bar Association is controlled by liberals and so that those ratings ought to not be counted as heavily. And there have been criticisms of some of the Trump ratings. Certainly the Trial Lawyers Association is one of the areas in which you will see Democrats looking for where they might draw potential nominees. What happens is the president and his advisors prepare longer lists of persons that are potential candidates. They keep those lists running at all times. They come from a variety of sectors. They may have even come from areas that may have donated to the president's campaign or persons that have been particularly supportive of a particular judge. Anybody who knows the background on Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg knows that her husband lobbied quite heavily for her to be pushed toward becoming a Supreme Court justice.
We're talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas, looking at the federal court system and the latest round of appointments to courts below the U.S. Supreme Court level and why they matter. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how this federal court system works and these appointments, the presidential nominations, the confirmation in the Senate? Are you worried about how political, how partisan the fights over these judge nominations have become? Do you think there's a way, there should be a way to make the process less partisan? And when you go to vote for a U.S. senator or a U.S. president, do you have these judicial nominations in mind when you cast your ballot? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the parts of the federal court system that don't get as much of a spotlight as the U.S. Supreme Court. A lot of the president's nominees getting approved now by the Republican Senate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the politics of the process behind how we get all of our judges at the federal level? Are judges and their appointments a voting issue for you? What questions do you have about how all this works? And is there an issue you're wondering about and how it might be affected by these changes in the makeup of federal courts? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kimmy King is with us, political scientist at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, let's talk about the politics of this now. In voting terms, is this something, this judge nomination issue, something that you think drives voters maybe even to vote for a candidate they might not otherwise like?
It's not not really clear that the actual vote on the Supreme Court justice, as much as I would like to say the Supreme Court nominations matter, it's not so much any one given justice that could make a difference. It's really more that there are certain kinds of litmus test issues. So, for example, under Ronald Reagan, for him, the issue of pro-life became very important. And while there was much rumor that he had made abortion a litmus test, it's not clear that that was ever actually the case or that anyone was so hopped up on any one candidate that they tried to oppose them. There was concern in the Kavanaugh nomination, and we have consistently seen the abortion issue come up in nomination hearings. The persons who are nominated for an associate justice or chief justice position on the court have kind of successfully avoided dealing with that. What will be important is that it's the overall view of the court and the shift that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is not a young woman. And when she steps down on off of the court, whoever is president, should she, you know, make it through to the 2020 election and remain on the court, will have the opportunity to replace her. And that will strategically shift the court if it's a Republican. And so that's what you're going to see the Republican Party and the Democratic Party focusing on.
In the past, we've seen judges at the Supreme Court level get appointed by one party or another and then end up voting in ways that aren't necessarily what I think the appointer expected. Do we see surprises like that as much these days at the Supreme Court or the lower court levels?
I'm not sure that you see that much these days. I mean, we're starting to be driven more into ideological corners. You did see Kavanaugh break on some procedural holdings from some of the other conservatives and vote along with Chief Justice John Roberts, who is himself considered to be a conservative, on some issues. But the days of someone like an Anthony Kennedy, who Kavanaugh replaced, being a moderate to conservative swing voter and coming in critical cases and shifting that balance, are not as readily apparent. What you do hear a bunch of people talking about is, especially as it relates to presidential power, I mean, let's focus on some of those key cases. How willing would the court be to limit presidential power? And certainly you have seen Chief Justice John Roberts act in ways that most people kind of thought were, sounds like he's standing up to the president a little bit. So we're just going to have to see how some of those things shake out over time. Many of the instances in which you've seen Roberts ruling against the president are really just cases that are procedural, and it's not necessarily deciding the substance of the merits. But there's much to indicate that Roberts is going to be his own man and that he's not going to just roll over in the face of presidential power.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mel is with us in New York. Mel, hi. Hi, Mel.
Yeah, right. So, thank you. So people didn't realize back in 2016, the presidential election, that the most important thing was about the Supreme Court judges, judge back then and judges subsequently, and all the other judges. They last for a lifetime and could be 20, 30, 40 years, and they shape policy. With the president, if you don't like his policy, you could change it after 4 years.
Mel, thanks for the call. Kimmy Mel saying maybe voters underrate the importance of this issue of appointing judges.
Oh, it's absolutely the case. And so to kind of put a fine point on what your caller was making, it's the difference between the impact of the federal judiciary and what the president can do in shaping policy over the course of the lifetime of his appointments to the federal courts versus whether or not the voting population is queued up enough to go in and to make the issue of, I care about presidential nominations enough to vote for a Democrat or a Republican. It's not the case. Public opinion polls indicate that there's any particular kind of justice that people will vote for, but they most undoubtedly do recognize the lasting impact that a president will have on the appointments to the court.
Mel, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas about the federal court system and what's going on a lot of times under the U.S. Supreme Court level. Lots of people getting approved recently, the president's appointees getting approved in the Republican-led Senate. Let's go back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Green Bay. Tom, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
So my question was going to be related to the Mueller report. So let's say if the Mueller report comes out and it shows that President Trump is compromised or he had colluded with Russia, in regards to his Supreme Court picks, as well as those lower court picks, what would happen in the case of, that report showing that the president is compromised? What's going to happen to those Supreme Court picks? Is there potential for them to be removed because,
Tom?
Well, yeah.
I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Kimmy, I'm guessing the answer is no takebacks, right?
Yeah, there's no takebacks. And that's one of the things that actually also piggybacks on what the last caller was saying, is that those nominees are not, It's late in the day and it's Friday. I'm very sorry.
That's okay.
It's the case that once they are appointed to the bench, you are appointed for life. And so if you look at Clarence Thomas, he's been on for over 27 years, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, 25, Breyer, 24, right? It doesn't matter if you were appointed by Bill Clinton and, you were impeached, but they failed to convict you, you still remain on the court. What it will do is that if there is the Mueller investigation there, it throws the rest of the government into chaos if there's something there that is explosive, that demands Senate Judiciary Committee attention, like a potential conviction trial, which they might have to face if, and that's a big if, the House gears up with impeachment proceedings. Remember, Nancy Pelosi has said that she thinks it's a waste of time to go after Trump on impeachment. So we're just going to have to wait for Mueller on that. But they are two different proceedings. What your caller's going to want to watch for is go look at the cases that Chief Justice Roberts has signed on to that relate to presidential power, dealing with immigration or executive orders. And there you will get an indication of whether they'd be willing to back the president on some kind of claim that, say, he can't be sued, for example, in some kind of private-related civil proceeding. Those are the things your caller's going to want to watch for.
Thanks, Tom. And briefly, Kimmy, as we wrap up, lifetime appointments for all these judges we're talking about, there is a mechanism to remove them, right?
In theory, yes, but it just doesn't happen as a practical matter. Many people were talking about that as it relates to Kavanaugh. What if there's other information or other women come forward? It's extremely difficult to do. Where you've seen and hasn't been done, William Chase was impeached way back in the early 1800s and never convicted. It has been more likely that federal district judges have been impeached and convicted in more recent years, but that's been few and extremely far between.
We'll leave it there. Kimmy, thanks as always for joining us.
You betcha. Always happy to join public radio. Support Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks. That's Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas. She was with us to talk about how our federal court system works and broader changes to the judiciary under the Trump administration. Coming up Monday on Central Time, a court ruled that a lawsuit by parents of Sandy Hook Elementary School children can go forward in an effort to hold a gunmaker partially liable for a mass shooting. We hear from an expert on gun policy and politics, and you can join the conversation. Some retailers around the country are ending cash transactions, and Philadelphia is the first big city to ban cashless stores. We'll look at the technology and the controversy. And a guest says Americans are developing an almost religious obsession with work. That's coming up Monday on Central Time.